You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
On this Easter weekend, we turn to Brother Richard Irby to talk with us, some thoughts of inspiration, St. Francis Medical Center, Archdiocesan Pastoral Council member, the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, with some inspirational thoughts as his work as a chaplain at St. Francis Medical Center in Linwood. Is it 37, 38 years? How many years have you been there now?
37 blessed years. Thank you for asking.
Wow. In 37 years, did you think you would see the things you have gotten to see?
I'm open to surprises and welcome them, but the answer is yes, I did.
You knew going in this would be different, so to speak.
Especially with the evolution of biomedical ethics, where the church can stand really proud in reference to the sacredness of life from conception until natural death, and all of the obstacles that stand in the way of the teaching in today's society as we become more and more secular. So, yeah, I sort of anticipated the struggle.
Okay. Now speak up, because we want to hear your story. Give us one of the stories of the things that happened in the life of someone for 37 years who's been bringing pastoral care as a chaplain. You see people, you told me one time, you see people on probably the worst day of their lives, right?
It is the worst day of their lives. And the secret to that, the Easter story, is turning that worst day of your life into something meaningful, something with purpose, something that is, we call redemptive suffering, where you take something ugly and you make it beautiful, where you take a tragedy and you make it an opportunity, where you can take the night and turn it into day. So being a level 2 trauma center here at St. Francis Medical Center in the inner city, Los Angeles, we probably deal with maybe an average of 3 and 4 deaths a day. And when I respond to those deaths, Larry, it's an opportunity for me to employ that sense of sacredness of life at that moment when people are feeling despair, cramming for finals, looking for options, and running scared. When I enter into one of the rooms, you all usually see the family rather confused and perplexed. And the first thing I do is I ask them to stand away from the bed. And they said, but we only have a few minutes. They say, there are other people coming. No, they left the room. I said, no. These are family members of your loved ones who have gone before them. We do not go to God alone. God sent his angels and his saints and our family to escort us to heaven. So it sort of is a pause moment where they reflect on the sacredness of that, what's happening. And they do. They step back. And then after a few moments, I allow them to come closer to the bed. And they say, you know, I said, we don't know the moment, the hour, the second when we will breathe our last. But I do know this, and it's when God calls our name. And your loved one is going to hear their name, Mary, Jane, Richard, David, Larry. They're going to hear their name, and that's God calling them home. And I take that from the Easter story, Larry, where Mary Magdalene on Easter Sunday went to the tomb. And this was a follower of Jesus. She knew him well. And yet she didn't recognize him when she saw him. She thought that they had stolen his body from the tomb. And so she asked one of the guards standing there, she said, you know, what have you done with my Lord? Where is he? Can you tell me? And she turned around and she thought she saw someone who was the gardener. And she says, where is the Lord? Do you know? What did you do with him? And then the Lord said, Mary. And she recognized his voice. And when he called her name, Mary. And then she embraced him and said, Lord, my God. And that's what happens to us at death. You know, when we leave the womb, it's difficult because we've been in there for 9 months. And we've been secure. We've been held. We've been fed. We've been warm. We hear our mother's heartbeat. And so when time comes, when the labor pain comes to enter into the world, we want to grasp and hold on to that comfort. But then once we come out of the womb, our mother calls us by name. The doctor places us in the bosom of our mother, and we're held again, and we feel caressed, and we're loved. And that's what it's like at death. When we leave this world, and we open our eyes in death, and we see the face of God, and he calls us by name, and he holds us, and we hear his heartbeat. There's nothing more beautiful than that. And where is beauty today? That's the question we should ask ourselves this Holy Week. Where do we see beauty today? It's becoming less and less visible to us. But beauty for us as Christians, beauty for us as believers in one God, is looking at his face. You know, when you look at the crucified Christ, some people think it's ugly, it's horrible, it's a tragedy. But if you look at that crucified Christ on the cross, it's beautiful to see someone who suffered so much on his own will for us. That's the ultimate sign of love. No greater love than to give your life for your friend. And that's what that's the image. You know, I had a physician. St. Francis is no longer a faith-based hospital. We were bought out by Prime Healthcare, which is a secular private hospital. But when they took over our hospital, they wanted to retain spiritual care because they wanted to have holistic health. They wanted to care for the mind, the body, and the spirit. But prior to the sale, they had taken down all of the religious articles and objects in the hospital. Well, the next morning, a physician calls me. He said, "Brother, I need your help." "What's up, doctor?" He said, "I had a patient in surgery last night, automobile accident. He was bleeding out, and we couldn't get the blood in fast enough. And I looked for the crucifix in that room. I was asking for help. I wanted to focus on something that was redemptive to give me some courage to continue." And he said, "My patient's bleeding out, and I look and I try to find that crucifix, and it's gone, brother. Where is it?" I said, "We're no longer a faith-based hospital, so the instructions were to take down the religious art." He said, "That can't be, brother." He said, "This is God's house, and we need to continue to have those images to remind us of what was done for us." 2 hours later, the crucifix was put back in the surgical suite.
Wow. That's a very impressive story. You know, as we come to us, as you can come to us and talk with us on this Easter weekend, you and I have talked about how this is the reason for the season. Those of us who enjoy getting Christmas presents as kids and all that, it would have meant nothing unless the Easter story were to be shared and were to be true. And as Jesus comes back, resurrection, that gives us all hope that there is something after this planet, isn't there?
You bring up a very good point, Larry. I was watching news, I won't mention the station, yesterday, and there's a segment on giving spring baskets to the children in the community. Spring baskets. Now I grew up calling them Easter baskets. It's no longer Easter break, it's spring break. So they're subverting the real meaning of what was our history and our legacy as a country, as a nation, as a world, as a people who follow one God. So yeah, it's not spring break. It's not a spring basket. It's certainly Easter. And Easter is the ultimate sign of hope. Death, but alive. Crucified, but risen. Placed in a tomb, but ascended. Just the opposite. You take that tragedy and you make it into a blessing. So that's what I hope your viewers can do this Easter when they gather with their families and their loved ones. It's look at them, see an image of a God who made them in his image, and be grateful and see the most beautiful sight that their eyes can behold.
Very important. Very important. Yeah. Spring baskets. I've never heard that term before, but people try to take the history out of history, I guess. And Easter is a time of year in which, the traditions of dressing up and going to the church service and families getting together, and sometimes they have an Easter meal together. I mean, there are a lot of traditions with this, and it's very special and very important, and one that should be kept alive, shouldn't it?
Absolutely. And we can learn from the Jews, from our Jewish brothers and sisters, the Passover. I mean, it's such a beautiful, beautiful, ultimate feast to to realize that, that God is passing over and that we need God in our lives in order to make sense of the chaos. And Easter is a reminder of that.
Final minute. What are some final thoughts you want to share this Easter season?
I think the most important thing, Larry, is to realize that as we continue to move on, we're being called to stand up and to knock on some difficult doors. And if we can just crack the door and allow morals and values to continue to prevail and to move forward, but it's going to take all of us to do that, to crack the door. We don't have to open the door wide. Others will be behind us. But if we can be an image of hope and assisting those who have less than we do to crack that door and to allow the light to shine through as it did in the tomb on Easter morning, we can't prefer darkness to light. And yeah, I think that's my final thought, is that let's all commit to cracking the door this year just a little bit wider and allow the diversity of faith, the diversity of culture, the diversity of ethnicities to enter in and to rejoice and to celebrate them and to realize that God is in the middle of all of that.
Brother Richard Irby, happy Easter.
Happy Easter, and God bless you and your viewers. I hope to have the opportunity again. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for taking time to be with us. Brother Richard Irby, a St. Francis Medical Center Archdiocesan Pastoral Council member and of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, sharing inspirational stories from his work as a chaplain at St. Francis Medical Center in Linwood. Thank you.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
The state official who oversees California's elections has given the go-ahead for groups who want to recall the governor. Here's reporter Phil Farrar.
Secretary of State Dr. Shirley Weber says signature gathering for a Gavin Newsom recall can take place. This is the latest effort to recall the governor. Last month, Rescue California says it was filing a notice of intent. The group says they can justify the recall because Newsom has failed to deal with the state's growing homelessness problem, high taxes, a large budget deficit, rising crime rates, and immigration issues. In 2021, Newsom easily fought off a recall effort. Opponents will have to gather more than 1.3 million signatures in a petition drive that will last until September 3rd. I'm Phil Farrar.
And to talk more about the recall effort, we go to, well, a regular around here, Ann Dunsmore. Ann, hi, Dunsmore. How you doing? Good morning to you.
Good morning. Ready for a recall day.
Wow. So, I mean, I hear them talking about it on the radio, and listeners say, oh, you know, I'll sign that. I'm excited. But that they also, some of them say things like, I don't know, if, you know, with 2 years left, whether it will pass, whether it's just going to be a waste of time, or maybe it'll motivate the Dems to help Gavin Newsom raise lots of money. And I go, the one to ask is Ann Hyde Dunsmore, because you obviously did this for a reason. So talk about what's going on and what it means.
Well, you can only be hit in the head so many times with the reasons why this guy shouldn't be governor before you actually have to go do something about it again. And there will always be doubters. There will always be people who are naysayers. I say that's fine. But there are also people who believe 100% that getting rid of them is the case. And then we just have to find a suitable replacement. That was the big question last time, was did we really lose or did just Larry Elder lose? And I think we know the answer there. What isn't lost on people now is that it's gotten 10 times worse. And we still have three more budgets and two more years with a man who clearly is not focused on solving this problem and, in fact, is doing things to make it worse.
Yeah. So what do you have to do? I heard that report there, like 1.3 million. What do you need for signatures? What do you
so mean? It's 1.3 million signatures valid. And in the strategy there is that if you do 125% of the required valid signatures, it literally has a trigger that takes you to a much easier place to get on the ballot. They don't count every single, they don't examine every single signature. So we feel quite confident. And remember, Larry, last time we had to get 2.3 million signatures, or that's what we turned in. We actually needed to get like 1.7, and then the buffer would take us to 2 million, and we turned in 2.3.
Yeah.
So that level of effort is not necessary. However, because of the previous effort and the network that was built, we're not starting from scratch. We're coming out of the gate with requests for 75,000 petitions. Mm. That's not people. That's petitions that 5,000 people are actively requesting from all over the state to be sent to them. And that process has started. We all sent, right. I actually emailed them all the petition last night.
So, and then you have till early in September, and then the idea is it, if it qualifies, would it be on this November's election?
Or? No. The window for qualification, now, if some kind of miracle happens and we get all those signatures in by, you know, sometime in May, arguably we could be on the November ballot. But I think the most important thing is that Gavin Newsom's going to be on the ballot every day between now and then. Every single thing he does is going to be under a Hubble microscope, if you will. And it needs to be, because he cannot be ignored. And the truth is, when people are focused on him, then he gets more focused. And so his buddies over in the legislature got to be biting their nails right about now, because a scared Gavin Newsom has no friends.
Mm.
He will take down anybody who's in his way with whatever agenda item he has. And in this case, it's going to be the budget.
Right,
right now,
yeah.
Even his $38 billion estimate of what the deficit is, which has been countered with a first $68 billion and then $73 billion estimate by the legislative analyst. He's saying he's only identified between $11 and $18 billion to offset that $38. So he's $20 billion off. And right now, the legislature, the Democrat legislators, are all sort of circling the wagons around their own pet project. He can't cut this. He better not cut that. He can't take that away. He better not touch this. That's what's going on. And they know that guy.
Yeah.
He will run over them.
Right.
Yeah.
Speaking of new things that may be proposed, a few months ago, there was a discussion about a wealth tax. Now I'm seeing this thing instead, California attempting an exit tax, prevent fleeing wealthy. It says in 2024, the state introduced a groundbreaking yet controversial financial measure, the exit tax, an unprecedented policy mandates that individuals relocating out of the state pay a tax on their net worth. Targeting those with substantial assets accrued within the Golden State. First off, you know, I mean, it's another Biden thing where it's probably not legal and they'll grab all this money and then they won't be able to use it. I mean,
I'm sure that his father-in-law, Tom Siebel, is very happy that he has already left for Florida, because that would be costing him a lot of money. A lot of Gavin Newsom's donors have already fled the state. Whether they wanted to be supportive of him or whether they were forced to be supportive of him because he's very punitive is the question. But yeah, you know, his father-in-law left the state while he was governor because it was an untenable financial situation.
Yeah.
So
I remember seeing the debate that Sean Hannity hosted with the Florida's governor DeSantis versus him. And DeSantis brought that up, pointing out that, one of your relatives has come to our state, you know, and all that.
Yeah.
So the exit.
Yeah, well, his own kids were going to school out of state. So, I mean, what do you do?
Yeah. All right. And then there was the wealth tax. He has said that he is not in favor of that, but that's before he found out the number that is owed. I'm a little under what would probably clip me on the wealth tax, but I don't know about you, Ann. You do pretty well over there.
I'm way under. I'm just above poverty level.
Okay.
But I don't, you know, other than my mother, I don't have children that are going to school and want to go to college. I'm not supporting a household that's probably got multiple generations in it, other than my mom, who doesn't live with me. But my kids have left the state. My mom doesn't live here. I have no family here other than, you know, other, you know, distant relatives. But, you know, this is why I can take something like this on. He can't take anything more away from me. he can't hurt me. But he, if you, you know, gas prices are spiking again. There are new statistics on crime that are overwhelming. But I think the thing that people have to understand is the financial situation, which is a very difficult thing to sort of break down. And as with anything that Gavin Newsom does, it's very complicated because he feels that he's complicated, not transparent, and throwing a lot of different things into the bowl that people tune out. And he's right. So we have to teach people that there is a very serious, there are very serious repercussions when there's no money. We can't even go to Wall Street and borrow money. We have to borrow it from internally from our own internal funds, like the reserve fund that we need to have or the general fund. When we need somebody who can undo that mess to come in. And fix it and have that be their sole focus. We are in a crisis mode. This is the Exxon Valdez, except California is not allowed, no state is allowed to declare bankruptcy. But if they could, we'd be in that situation. We have the highest net deficit of any state in the country, in the history of the country. We now have a net deficit of $222 billion.
So why
a quarter of a trillion dollars?
So why did we get into the health benefits for all illegal?
Because he turns a blind eye to these things because he can check a box for the moment that's politically persuasive. Oh, here, love me. I'm going to give everybody everything, even though I don't have the money. I'm going to use your money, or now I'm going to use reserve money when, you know, and he's still is out there bragging about the fact that we're, you know, healthy financially and economically. And it's just patently untrue. And people are starting to see the repercussions of that. So it's not even an interesting time. It's too serious to make it scary. It's something we have to do something about. We can't be scared about it. We have to do something about it. And that's what Rescue California is doing. It's rescuecalifornia.org, Larry, not .com. It's rescuecalifornia.org. We are recalling the governor. We will get on the ballot, and many things will happen when people see the seriousness of this people's movement that is unparalleled since Howard Jarvis and Prop 13 and the whole tax revolt in the 70s and 80s in California. And we're going to see that again, and it's going to be very powerful. I already see it, and I think people will take great comfort as we move along. They're going to see that there is that there is success and there is a light at the end of the tunnel, but only if people have the spinal fortitude to do what this type of great battle requires, because we have to fight it. Or we have to give into it, and I don't think anybody wants to give into it.
All right, last time.
Especially now that he's going to tax them as they leave.
There you go. Give us the website to get a hold of getting these papers sent to you to sign. Where do you go?
Well, we will be posting today the petitions to recall. You can pull them down, download them from rescuecalifornia.org. rescuecalifornia.org.
Got to leave it there because I'm just simply out of time. Thank you so much. Appreciate you being on the program today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Up next, Jim Ellis takes a look at the Week in Review in Politics. Jim Ellis from ellisinsight.com. That's next. Stay with us.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer. You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
On this Easter weekend, we want to check in with Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com, the Ellis Insight, for a look at what's going on in the news. And first off, happy Easter to you.
And happy Easter to you and everyone out there.
That's right. All right, let's get to it. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has picked his presidential running mate. Here's the announcement.
I'm so proud to introduce to you the next Vice President of the United States, Nicole Shanahan.
All right, a 38-year-old attorney and tech entrepreneur, one who brings to the team some extensive wealth, and we can talk a bit about that. What's your thoughts here?
Not only extensive wealth, but she's hard to the left, too. So Kennedy went very hard left with this choice. She's an environmental activist, and in the past, you know, she's contributed to heavily Democratic candidates. In 2020, she contributed to both Pete Buttigieg and Marianne Williamson, which should tell us a lot about her. So I think, though, that his main purpose in taking her is because she's extremely wealthy and actually funded that ad. I think it was $4 million, if I had read it correctly, on the Super Bowl. You might remember, if you watched the Super Bowl, that ad about the Kennedy family history and promoting Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and she was largely responsible for airing that ad. So I think he went to the left, and he went to the financial resources.
Yeah. Here is Nicole Shanahan explaining why she's not a Democrat anymore.
Many Democrats, we still believe in those ideals, but unfortunately, as an institution, it has lost its way.
And she talks about why she, she talks about her wealth a bit here, too.
As you probably know, I became very wealthy later on in life. But my roots in Oakland taught me many things I've never forgotten. That the purpose of wealth is to help those in need.
All right, so the purpose of wealth is to help those in need. Big question for you to analyze is, whom do these two draw from in an election? Your thoughts.
I don't think Nicole Shanahan really affects who the independent ticket now draws from. It's all going to be Kennedy, and it's all going to be really, if people don't want Biden or Trump. Early on, it looked like the independents combined, which is Kennedy. You've got the Libertarian eventual candidate, Jill Stein of the Green Party, Dr. Cornel West. Combined, they could get up into the 20s. And originally, it looked like they drew a little bit more from Trump. And today, according to polls, and really for about the last 2 months, it's been they draw a little bit more from Biden. And I think that's why the Biden campaign is definitely concerned about Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
All right, take us into the Ronna McDaniel, a life after being the chair of the RNC, and her short-lived stint at NBC.
On Monday, Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski said on MSNBC's Morning Joe they hope NBC reconsiders the decision to hire McDaniel. That came a day after former Meet the Press anchor Chuck Todd blasted the hiring during NBC's flagship political show. NBC Universal News Group President Cesar Conde said in a memo to staff, after listening to the legitimate concerns of many of you, I've decided that Ronna McDaniel will not be an NBC News contributor. I'm Michael Kastner.
Well, I guess that's what you get for trying to appease your political opponents, because that obviously didn't go too well. I'm sure she'll get a nice contract still out of them. I mean, they did sign her to a contract, so I'm sure she's going to make quite a bit of money for now doing nothing. But it's really no surprise, because there is no such thing, at least in these major networks, of balanced journalism. They simply don't want that. They want to be advocacy organizations.
Yeah. And in fact, what happened was you had the on-air talent, and I put quotes around that, from the different NBC properties complaining about the hire. Something that is not always, endorsed in the broadcast medium. There have been many outlets, when you comment on a coworker being brought on or what the status, you're out. I mean, they did take a chance at doing this, but apparently the management at NBC is more interested in a, quote, cohesiveness of their liberal group of employees, keeping them happy, than actually having a fair and balanced presentation by someone on the other side, right?
Yes, I think they're more interested in promoting the left-wing agenda than they are in delivering and reporting upon news stories in an unbiased fashion. That's just out the window now. So we really don't see the old time journalism of just the facts. And it's now all based upon advocacy.
Yeah. And well, just the idea. Can you imagine getting on the air at a broadcast facility that you don't own and railing on a new hire? I mean, in some cases, you know, that would be a line to the HR office and you'd be terminated.
Well, oftentimes that would be the case. Certainly not with NBC News. In fact, they were rewarded for doing that. So I'm sure we'll see more of that behavior here in the future.
It's kind of like what the in the insane asylum, the inmates taking charge.
Yes.
All right. What else?
It's analogous. It's analogous to the Biden administration, isn't it?
What else is going on?
Well, we've got, you know, the campaigns now, we're looking more towards the general election. We're in primary season. We've gone through Super Tuesday. We've gone through the Ohio and Illinois primaries. We've got kind of a respite now until May. There's only one primary in April, and that is in Pennsylvania on April 23rd. And then we go to a series of primary events in May and early June, actually culminating through late June. So May and June are the big primary months around the country for the Senate and the House and their statewide tickets. And so I think we're going to see a lot of action at that point in time. So campaigns right now are jockeying for position to get these nominations and then moving on into the general election. But in some of these critical states, like we've already seen with Super Tuesday, like California, like Ohio, we now are in the general election cycle, which is a very long one. And obviously we are in the presidential race too, which will be the longest general election cycle in history, because we've never had two presumptive nominees so early in the election cycle as we do this time.
Well, whenever I talk about California and the congressional seats that are available there, that, you know, people say, well, the road to Republicans' continued control of the House goes directly through California, that there must win seats out here to keep things in place. Your thoughts?
Yes, there's a lot to that. I mean, it's certainly one of the states. New York is another one. It's ironic that the two weakest Republican states are where they need to score big to maintain their majority. But you've got four seats in the California delegation where in 2022, the Republican candidate won seats that were really drawn to elect Democrats. And the encouraging thing for Republicans at this point is that all four of those performed very well in the jungle primary. And particularly you have a seat up in Northern California in the Central Valley, the Modesto area, or San Joaquin Valley up there, that they John Duarte, who won by just over 500 votes, it was the second closest race in the whole country. And he has the same opponent that he defeated in 2022, and only the two of them filed. So the jungle primary was really a straight precursor on what's going to happen in the general election. And the new Republican congressman, John Duarte, he got 55% of the vote, which I think was exceeded anybody's expectations in a seat that's rated as D plus seven, you know, that a Democrat should win by 7 points. So I would think the Republican strategists were very encouraged by those primary results.
Yeah,
not only with Steve Garvey, but in these House races as well. So
sure.
I think they're well positioned now.
Take the 27th Congressional District, Mike Garcia out here.
He's
in a district that is plus on the Democrat side, but he continued to hold that. You had the Scott Baugh race where he'll face Dave Mann, or sometimes called DUI Dave, out here. And that's the one where Katie Porter left to run for a Senate seat in which she didn't make the final two. And at first she called the process rigged, which got her some criticism from Democrats. And then she took that back in a podcast, apologizing for using that.
Yes. Well, I guess she was an election denier too, right? But yes, so that was the other point. So not only do the four incumbents in these Democratic seats perform well, but you're absolutely right, Larry. You have Scott Baugh in that open Orange County seat of Katie Porter's, the 47th district. That would be a Republican game, and they're in good position with Scott Baugh to make that very highly competitive and perhaps pull that off. So the California results in that primary, again, I think that the Republicans have to be very pleased with that, and it is something to build upon Now, it's still not a slam dunk because the turnout's going to be much higher, of course, in the general election. But this positions them very well, I think, to be able to do what they need to do, which is win those four seats they already have. And if Scott Baugh can win, that is just a huge plus for them nationally.
Yeah, and into the L.A. County DA's race, Nathan Hochman will face Gascon, and that should be interesting to watch. There's not a lot of love for Gascon out here because crime has touched a lot of people's lives, and you don't really have to do a lot of advertising about that.
I think Gascon's in real trouble there because, remember, he only got a little under 22% of the vote. That means that 78% of the people who voted didn't vote for him. And that is a very bad sign for any incumbent. Normally, in races like this, where everybody's on the same ballot, you know, the incumbent needs to get over 50% to feel secure. Gascon couldn't even get to 25. So I think he's in very serious trouble. And this is good, very good sign to in terms of defeating him.
Mm-hmm. There's an effort out here. It's been given the go-ahead, another recall attempt against Governor Gavin Newsom. The Secretary of State has given the thumbs up on that. Over a million-plus signatures have to be gathered. There is a lot of angst about this governor. I don't know if it can be successful, but they may get those signatures pretty easily.
They may be able to get the signatures again, yes. It probably turns out the way the first recall did, but he's going to have to run another campaign and raise and spend millions and millions of dollars. And he sure didn't like that last time. And if he has to do it again, I'm sure he's just really going to blow his stack.
All right, final 30 seconds. Some final thoughts for the week.
Well, again, I think we just need to begin to look forward in terms of how the two campaigns at the presidential level are beginning to set the tone for the general election. And you see Biden already trying to do some things to make himself more palatable to the public and try to correct some of what are obvious glaring weaknesses. And I'm not sure he's going to be able to do it, but they're certainly trying.
Jim Ellis, EllisInsight.com, The Ellis Insight. We thank you for your report. And
thank you so much, Larry.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
My guest is John Lott, Jr., Ph.D. He's president of the Crime Prevention Research Center.
It's great to be on. Thanks very much for having me on.
So what is this story where a judge is suggesting that an illegal immigrant has the right to have a gun? Kind of walk us into this story because you've got an interesting take on this thing.
Right. Well, there's a federal district court judge from the Northern District of Illinois, an Obama appointee, who made the conclusion that illegal aliens have the right to have guns with them. This individual lied on the form to go and purchase the gun, which is a felony. Obviously, he's in the country illegally. I think it's just an attempt by Obama appointed judge to try to create problems for people who support the Second Amendment, because they'll say, you know, even conservatives will say, you know, this goes too far and, you know, maybe we ought to rethink the Second Amendment, I suppose. The irony is that the Democratic judges who are saying that it's okay for states to ban law-abiding Americans from being able to go and carry are saying it's okay for illegal aliens to be able to go and carry. So, you know, it's just, it seems pretty clear that it's just an attempt to try to create chaos. I mean, our people who are not legally in the United States, I mean, from the beginning, if you were a pirate or something, you could have stopped somebody from being able to go and carry a gun or have a gun in the United States. They arrested those people, took them into custody. And so, you know, this is not something new, even though we haven't had, you know, kind of the category of illegal aliens per se in the United States from the beginning of the country.
Yeah, and it's really, this ruling is to try to pit Second Amendment rights, people who believe in it, by being able to say, aha, you Second Amendment people, you really aren't thinking that it's a all or none thing. You're thinking there are limits to it. And I don't think anyone said that there aren't limits. I mean, most Second Amendment people think you can't yell fire in a theater, that you can't do certain things, that there's certain things we've gotten to. But when it comes to illegals, I don't think most people are for illegal immigrants having guns. Do you?
Well, you can say that there's, you know, it's very broad what the Second Amendment covers, but the issue is, does it apply to American citizens or not? I mean, is it a Bill of Rights for American citizens? And when the term the right of the people is used, the, you know, there's different times where the Constitution will say people versus the people. And when it's used the term the people, the Supreme Court has interpreted that as applying to American citizens. And so, you know, there's just certain protections that are granted to American citizens that aren't granted to foreigners.
Yeah. John Lott is with us. You and I were talking about a story before we taped here in kind of like looking at artificial intelligence and various sites, and you actually have posted on your site some work from your son, Maxim, who's been looking at the bias by AI. You know, they have these new chat things where you can type a question. You know, you could even type this one in. Right. I haven't done it yet. We should go do it and see it. Should an illegal immigrant be allowed to own a gun in the U.S.? I'll see what it says. I'll type it in while you're answering the question here. But take us into this story of trying to talk to these computers and determining their bias on guns. Tell us what you did.
Right. Well, I mean, kind of inspired by my son's work there, we wanted to go and see what views you would get back from these artificial intelligence chatbots on crime and gun control issues. So we would ask some questions like, do you think higher arrest rates, higher conviction rates, longer prison sentences deter criminals? The average response from these was what you would regard as liberal, saying that no, it doesn't. You look at things like Facebook's AI or Google's AI, and they would say strongly disagree that higher arrest rates and conviction rates, et cetera, reduce crime. You go and ask them any questions on gun control from things like red flag laws or assault weapons bans or what have you. And they would take the strongest positions in favor of any gun control law that you would go and ask them about.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got one for you. I just looked it up on Copilot. That's one of them. And I wrote, should an illegal be allowed to own a gun? And it wrote back, I'm sorry, but I can't continue this conversation. If you have any other questions or need information on a different topic, feel free to ask. So part of the thing is they avoid it, right? They just don't go there if they don't want to admit, no, they shouldn't. They move to this,
yeah,
move
on. On occasion they do that, but unfortunately many times they're very strong. I mean, here we have students, we have reporters, we have researchers who are using AI in order to help them with their work that's being done. And it's pretty clear to me that there's a definite, strong leftward tilt. Now, one thing that was interesting, the most balanced, AI in terms of, its views on crime and gun control was Mistral, which is a French, artificial intelligence one. They were kind of right in the middle on these issues. And, Elon Musk's, Grok, was actually conservative. It's the only ones that was conservative on crime, but even they were giving fairly liberal gut supportive answers for all the different types of gun control laws.
Yeah.
But the ones that were most prominent are the most prominent Google's Gemini and Facebook's Llama. They were by far the most left-wing.
So the deal is the AI doesn't learn and give you intelligence, it repeats how it's been programmed. There's a thumb on the scale here, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, in many different ways. One way is just what type of information it weights. I mean, it goes through and it's looking through everything on the internet, but they'll weight information from certain sources, you know, maybe like Bloomberg's gun control groups. They'll give a weight to that, but they won't give a weight to things that might be from other types of researchers on there that they regard as untrustworthy. And so, you know, you have a real bias there in terms of even what information it's willing to go and look at to go inform its answers to. But I worry You know, just like Google, when you go and search, there's been a lot of research that's shown that Republican candidates, their websites, or even Robert F. Kennedy Jr., people would go and try to search for his website during the Democratic primaries when he was running as a Democrat. And Google would refuse to show you his website.
Yeah.
You know, those types of things impact people's views. I mean, if you go and you search for Democratic candidates for president and they don't show you that Kennedy was even running at the time that he was running, you know, maybe that would have cost them some votes that were there.
Yeah. Have you, in your own experience, found that the internet in its own way seems to suppress your content? You have put up content, a lot of it, and, you know, although it's probably liked by more of the conservatives and it's, you know, a right to ownership and the truth about the stats, there are some that don't want that message out there, do they?
In 2016, our website, crimeresearch.org, we were getting 100,000 unique hits every month. And then all of a sudden, in the middle of January 2017, our traffic fell by about 98%. We were down to a couple thousand, just suddenly in one day, went down to just a couple thousand hits a day. And at the same time, many conservative websites also saw a huge drop in their traffic. And basically what happened was Google's search engine, you know, decided at that point, you know, I think in reaction to the 2016 election, just decided that they were going to go and censor a lot of different kind of websites that they regarded as conservative. And we've never recovered in terms of our website traffic after that point.
Yeah.
And you know, I assume this is just one example of them trying to put their thumb on their scale, as you say, to try to change people's views. Because if you, you know, you do a search and gun control groups or, you know, the New York Times or whatever come up right there at the top of your searches. But the ones that would be providing an alternative viewpoint, you know, the research. I mean, we have academics at Harvard, University of Chicago, the Wharton Business School, University of Michigan, Emory, other top universities across the country who do research for our group. And you would think, well, you know, that seems somewhat credible. You would think that they would kind of weight all these academic researchers. But no, they decided that they'd rather go and put things from Michael Bloomberg's groups up there at the top than research from academics.
So, and I've only got a minute left. The debate becomes like the Fed's going after Apple for antitrust or some sort of uncompetitive thing.
Right.
Where does it stand when it comes to these search engines? Can you do the same thing, or is it free speech, or could the government nab them and break them up and say, hey, your algorithm's unfair? Or since they like the results, since most of, you know, entrenched government tends to be on the left, it's never going to happen. 30 seconds.
Right. Well, I guess I'm worried that the government will use its power often to kind of push things in a certain political direction that they want it to be pushed in. You know, I'm not thrilled about Google and what have you, but I think the answer is having competition. So, you know, by putting out there the fact that Mistral is kind of balanced and Elon Musk provides alternative views and his AI, you know, that he's willing to have his AI say that higher arrest rates and conviction rates deter criminals. You know, maybe people will decide that they should start using that.
Yeah. And it doesn't seem too illogical if they're locked up. There's one thing they're not doing is committing crime, you know? Oh, well, you got to use your mind sometime. Just think. Hey, thank you so much for being with us on the program again.
Oh, no, thank you very much.
That, of course, is John Lott, Jr., PhD, President, Crime Prevention Research Center. Out of time on this edition of our program. We'll see you again next week for Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer.